This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2 years after the Taliban fled Kabul, the one-time rulers of Afghanistan have reestablished themselves in some parts of the country and present a growing political and military challenge. While the government of Hamid Karzai promulgates a proposed constitution and looks ahead towards a new tribal council next month and the prospect of elections next year, many question how much authority it commands outside the capital. Regional warlords operate beyond Kabul's control and reap the profits of a resurgent trade in opium. American and allied troops are still there, about 11,000 of them, and they continue to conduct military operations. But, according to reports, they face about 20 attacks a month themselves. Later in the program, we'll take a look at the life and career of one of the great pitchers in baseball history. Warren Spahn died yesterday. But first, Afghanistan, 2 years after the fall of the Taliban. We'll bring you an update on the war, on Reconstruction, and on steps towards democracy. If you have questions, and especially if you visited or know people in Afghanistan, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now from Kabul is Pamela Constable, the Kabul Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. And thanks for being with us so late at night.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Muslims around the world are celebrating the Eid. That marks the end of Ramadan. And I was wondering, what was that like earlier today in Kabul?
Well, I can't hear you very well, but I hope you can hear me. Eid is extremely cold, but very pleasant and bright today. People were out across Kabul. Children were flying kites, playing games. Everyone was busy visiting relatives and eating a great deal after a long month of eating very little. So it's in spite of quite a bit of depressing news and cold weather, it was really a lovely day today.
What is the political atmosphere in Kabul right now?
In Kabul, it's fairly upbeat. As you mentioned, people are looking ahead to the National Assembly or Loya Jirga in December when they will be discussing and ratifying a proposed constitution. People are very busy. Business is booming. There's been a great deal of construction, lots of investment pouring into the capital. So there's really a positive feeling both economically and politically in the capital. The problems, as you mentioned, are generally speaking outside in the countryside where the authority and the muscle of the government is quite weak.
One thing that we would like you to update us on, if you know, there was a helicopter crash. Five Americans were killed and seven others injured near the Bagram Air Base, not far from Kabul. What do we know about that?
We don't really have a lot of details yet. It's fairly clear that this was an accident, not any sort of attack. As I understand it, the helicopter was returning from an operation that's currently taking place in the eastern border provinces of Kunar and Nuristan, where American troops have been hunting down remnants of the Taliban and other potential enemies of the government. But this was not an attack of any kind. This helicopter was not shot down. It was either a mechanical or a human failure, and the chopper crashed fairly near home base, Bagram Air Base, which is just about 50 miles north of Kabul. But we don't know the exact cause yet.
You say remnants of the Taliban. Some people are describing it really as the neo-Taliban and say that these forces at least are claiming to be able to move with impunity almost anywhere in Afghanistan.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I would certainly say that in large pockets of the country, especially in the south and southeast, they are definitely moving at will. Many of them are using motor scooters, motorcycles, to move quickly from place to place. They do hit-and-run attacks, sabotage attacks. They've killed a number of people, including a French United Nations worker, a woman who was killed in the city of Ghazni on November 16th. But that was just the most high profile of a number of attacks that have occurred over the last several months. I'm not sure if the word remnants or neo-Taliban is more accurate. We don't really know exactly who these people are, but they do seem to have some of the same leadership as the original Taliban movement, which was not wiped out. It was essentially pushed back towards the border with Pakistan. It has now regrouped to a certain extent and is certainly in a position to cause trouble, far from having the ability to take power, but certainly in a position to cause trouble and worry throughout a fairly large region of the country.
What's been the military response?
The military response has been, I would say, somewhat sporadic and certainly not enough at this point. The coalition forces have led several major combat operations in the east. There's one going on right now against these forces. There was a fairly successful operation last month in Zabul province to drive back these Taliban or extremist guerrillas from a large area of that province. But there has not been anything like a sustained or comprehensive effort to crack down on these saboteurs or terrorists. The Americans and some of the European forces are beginning to establish regional armed reconstruction teams in certain areas, which they hope will provide a more long-term deterrent to these kinds of activities and enforcement for stability and against violence. So that's a relatively new concept that hasn't really begun to take hold in these dangerous areas.
Let's get back to politics there in Kabul. As you mentioned, the Loya Jirga meets next month, I think on December 9th, to talk about the draft constitution. How big an event is that? Does that look like being there?
It's a very big event in the country's history. Everybody here is well aware of the importance of establishing a constitution as a precursor to holding national elections. This country has not had elections in a very long time, and in many ways it's really never had modern democratic elections as we know them. The last constitution was in 1964. Between now and then, or then and now, there's been many years of chaos, civil war, violence, and repression. So this is a very important step in what's known as the Bonn process, the United Nations mandated transition towards democratic rule in Afghanistan. The document, as proposed, has come under heavy criticism from a variety of fronts, including human rights groups, students, some religious groups that don't think it goes far enough towards upholding Islamic law. And many, many critics have already emerged, but generally speaking, there's a strong positive feeling that at least this is one more important step to be reached in the very difficult transition towards democratic rule.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN@npr.org. And on the line with us is T. Kumar in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, this is Kumar from Amnesty International. As a human rights organization, we are extremely concerned about the new constitution that's been drafted and to be debated on December 10th. That's a human rights day. Our concern is women's rights and children's rights have been completely ignored and did not give any protection to these most vulnerable groups, which they experienced abuses over the years, especially under Taliban. My question to the panel, especially to Pamela, who is in Pamela Constable, who is in Kabul, is that what type of difference this constitution is going to make to the women and children of Afghanistan?
It's a very good question, and he's right. The draft document says very little about that issue. It makes some very broad, sweeping statements about rights for women and equality for men and women in many areas of life, but does not spell out specifically the kind of rights for women, children, and other groups that many human rights organizations and others would have wished. What's happening now is that the draft is open to public comment, and it will be open for very serious and substantive debate at the Constitutional Assembly in December. So there is certainly the potential for this to change, for the document to embrace these rights more specifically. However, it's my expectation that more of the criticism at the Assembly will come from the right, that is, from the religious groups and from other groups, the warlords and others who have a very different agenda than the one Mr. Kumar mentioned.
Mr. Kumar, thanks very much for calling. Bye-bye. Let's get a call in from, this is Nate, and Nate's with us from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I got a phone call last week from Mohsen, who's a guy that I met in North Carolina back in the 80s, and he just gave up in Kandahar, and he's moved back to Iran. The reason is there's no control. Under the Taliban, the for better or for worse, poppy production was brought down to near zero. And immediately after the United States entered into Kabul and took over, they turned down an offer by the Europeans and other Muslim countries to contribute 30,000 troops to try and stabilize the countryside of Afghanistan. But once they turned those guys down, they didn't do anything else. There is no central government control beyond 15 miles outside of Kabul. The United States of America chose not to allow other people in there. We did not give the people in Afghanistan the assets, the money, and the training for them to establish their own central government, and we haven't put troops of our own in there. So it's completely predictable that you've got a resurgence of drug lords and a complete control of factional warlords in the entire country of Afghanistan once you get beyond Kabul. And it's directly the result of a decision that was made by this administration, and nobody is holding them accountable.
Pam Constable, there are numbers of European troops, as you mentioned, in Afghanistan, but tell us about that, and tell us also about the resurgence that Nate was talking about in the drug trade.
Yes, he did raise a number of issues there. There are about 11,000 American troops. There are another 5,000 multinational peacekeepers in Kabul, and there is a nascent Afghan army as well as a fairly large, although not very well-trained, Afghan defense force. The issue is not lack of troops, as he suggests. It is, in fact, a lack of central authority, the competition for power in many parts of the countryside. This is a country that in many ways is not a country. It's been ruled by tribal chiefs and militia leaders for a very long time, and that's very difficult to change. I don't know exactly about the offer he mentioned from others, but it is true that when the coalition forces came in, they very quickly took up with many of these militia leaders that the Americans felt they needed to help combat al-Qaeda and Taliban. They didn't look terribly closely at their credentials. And now some of these same militia leaders are still causing a great deal of difficulty in the countryside. And, yes, the problem of opium poppies and the drug trade has absolutely skyrocketed as a byproduct, a partial byproduct of this problem over the past 2 years. One of the great ironies is that the Taliban, for a variety of reasons, some of which may have been good and others bad, they may have actually been trying to drive up the price of poppies, but nevertheless, the Taliban did manage to almost virtually wipe out poppy production, opium poppy production, several years ago. And as soon as they...
Pam Constable, I'm afraid we're...
They came back.
I'm afraid we're running out of time, but thank you so much for staying up very late there in Kabul to speak with us.
You're very welcome.
Pamela Constable of the Washington Post. We'll have more on Afghanistan after a break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Afghanistan 2 years after the fall of the Taliban. If you have family there, if you've worked or visited there, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is a reporter who's covered Afghanistan and Pakistan for the past 15 years for the Associated Press. Kathy Gannon is with us from our bureau in New York, where she's spending this year as the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The situation that Pamela Constable was describing before we went to the break, it's almost like a dual momentum of excitement and anticipation of the upcoming Loya Jirga mixed with concerns about safety and terrorist attacks. Is that an approximation of what it was like before you left in September to come to New York?
Sure. I think security is really a big, big issue right now in Afghanistan, and the concern about the area outside of Kabul, but also Kabul as well. There was a rocket attack that hit very close to the Intercontinental Hotel, which is where a number of foreigners stay, which is right in the middle of Kabul. So security is a really big, big concern, and I think there is a great deal of anticipation about the Loya Jirga for this new constitution. And with that, a lot of concerns from ordinary Afghans that it goes far enough to protect individual rights and that the government really makes an effort to try and improve the security, not just in the regions, but also in Kabul, but certainly the regions.
Mm-hmm. One important issue has also been reconstruction, and obviously security makes it very difficult to go on and construct roads and that sort of thing, schools and whatever. Has that been able to make much progress during the summer, which is, of course, when most of that is possible to be done?
Sure, you're absolutely right. There certainly is some construction going on. The road between Kabul and Kandahar, a major roadway, is being built. But it's been 2 years, and a lot of ordinary Afghans are hugely disappointed at the pace of reconstruction. It has been very, very slow. There is very, very little that has been done. Very few large projects that have been completed 2 years later. So there's a great deal of disappointment from the ordinary Afghans who thought after they were, after the attack and the Taliban left and being the first frontline state in the war on terror, that they would receive a great deal of assistance. And I think they really feel that hasn't happened. There has been some, but certainly not a lot. And it is partly a security problem. It also partly a lack of a real commitment, I think, from the international community.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller in. This is Amin, who joins us from Stockton, California.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. I would like to comment on the warlords. I was there last year in Kabul for a month. And the feeling that I got is people are getting so much upset and disappointed with the policy of this government's, the United States government, by supporting the president and the warlords at the same time. And they are not going on the same route. The president is a clean person, President Karzai. But the warlords, some of them are worse than the worst of Taliban. They rape young boys in the broad daylight in front of their father. They were the one who actually escorted terrorists out of the Tora Bora caves 2 years ago with money, took money from them and they escorted them out. They are involved in drug trades. Now, supporting the warlords this time is actually undermines the central government and the people are losing hope. I think the reason the security is getting worse and worse is because the people are not helping the central government or the coalition forces, because they are afraid that these thugs, these warlords, were nobodies 2 years ago. Now they are in power. Who are we supporting? We are supporting the warlords if they are supporting the military operations there.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a response from Kathy Gannon.
Amin is absolutely right. And I think that the whole issue of warlords has become a misnomer today in Afghanistan, because those warlords are part of the government. He's absolutely right about the president, Hamid Karzai, but some real strong action has to be taken if you're going to gain some control. These warlords are actually cabinet ministers. They're defense minister, they're urban affairs minister, they're governors. They're governors in the provinces of Afghanistan. They are commanders in the provinces in Afghanistan, put there by the central government, and are part of the central government. So it's a very difficult issue, but I mean, it's very right. People are frustrated, they're disappointed. They don't see some real strong action by President Hamid Karzai and by the coalition to take this in hand. Instead, these people are now all a part of the government. So it's all, almost become a misnomer to call them warlords. And they also are the ones who are allowing the drug trade to flourish. And it is flourishing in Afghanistan, and it's being grown in areas that previously did not grow poppies. So it's not just increasing, but it's increasing in areas that previously didn't have poppies, and that's a very discouraging trend. And it's not happening without the connivance of the very people who have been put in by the government in Kabul and supported by the U.S. administration.
So do people perceive the government in Kabul of President Karzai and these, we call them warlords, but I guess if they're provisional provincial authorities, they're provincial authorities, do they see them as a piece, or do they see the provincial authorities as being outside the control of the government?
They see the provincial authorities being outside the control of President Hamid Karzai, but they do not see them as being outside the control of, for example, the defense minister, Mohammed Fahim. Some of them are very much controlled by the defense ministry. The urban affairs minister, who is in charge of housing, used to be the governor in Kandahar, who the president removed from Kandahar as governor because he was corrupt and incompetent, and put him as urban affairs minister. Now, that's the person that the State Department has to deal with to try and get money for housing. So there's a real problem with the cabinet itself. And I think there's a great deal of disappointment among Afghans that the president is not taking some really strong decisions in terms of who he is allowing in his cabinet.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is David, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Yes, I have not been to Afghanistan, but I have an immediate member of the family who is. He is a ranking officer in a field a reconstruction team in the western province, assigned under the jurisdiction of a warlord who is accumulating vast wealth. His activities are reported in the most recent issue of National Geographic. My question is this to the panel. A lot of our men and women in the U.S. Armed Forces are assigned to these field reconstruction teams whose primary mission is to accelerate the reconstruction of civil structure. For instance, recently, my immediate member of the family was involved in diverting a river back to its original course to bring a village back into Afghanistan. The river changed its course, and all of a sudden the village is isolated in the neighboring country of Iran, which was creating a potential dispute. While these activities are taking place, the question is this: what level of confidence do members of the panel have that the warlords and the provincial governors will realize they have to participate in a redistribution of wealth in support of financing the central government?
Kathy Gannon, is this going to work?
Well, the warlords, in fact, are the governors. The person he's referring to is the governor of Herat, Ismail Khan. He's a governor. That is what the hope is. So far, there hasn't been evidence of that, unfortunately. Ismail Khan has made hundreds of millions of dollars. Very little of it has been given to the central government in the east, in Nangarhar province. As well, the governor and the corps commander there have made, again, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that, again, is not going to the federal government. Some is going. A very, very small amount is actually getting to the central government. So, unfortunately, it isn't. Evidence has not indicated that that is what is happening. That's certainly the hope, that they would get on board and embrace this whole process and not be thinking solely of making money for themselves. Unfortunately, on the ground, it seems that they have opted to make money for themselves and give very little to this central government.
David, thanks very much. And when you speak to your brother, wish him the best, will you?
Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Bye-bye. Joining us now on the phone from here in Washington is Karen Hanrahan, who spent 8 months in Afghanistan conducting a survey of women living in four of the western provinces of the country for the United Nations Refugee Agency. That's the UNHCR, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
What was the purpose of your survey?
Actually, the survey did not last the entire 8 months. It was basically to assess the situation of returnees in the four western provinces, returnee women in particular, and girls. And the result was that it gave us a window into not only the experience of these returnees, but just of women in the Western provinces in general.
And when you speak of returnees, I assume that these are women and girls who lived in refugee camps in Pakistan?
Actually, in the West, they were primarily from Iran. We did interview some returnees from Pakistan, but most of them had returned from Iran.
And what did you find?
Well, we found many, many things. One of the basic themes that came out of it was that there appears to be a disconnect between some of the discussions, policies, planning that's going on in Kabul, where much of the international community's focus much of the discussion is focused there in Kabul, and the actual experience of women out in the provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And their experiences varied a significant amount depending on whether they were from rural areas or urban areas. It also varied by their age, by their experience, but ultimately it revealed that there's a very complex, diverse experience that women are having in Afghanistan that is not fully being recognized at all levels.
I understand it's hard to generalize, but if there are concerns in Kabul as they look at that proposed constitution that it does not do enough for women and children, is that the response that you got from talking to women and girls in the Western provinces?
The women and girls in the Western provinces, particularly in rural areas, which is where the majority of women and girls are, they were not even aware of the dialogues, of the discussion that there is a constitution being drafted. Their primary concern was to get food, was to find a way to bring money into the home. Their lack of health care, the lack of assistance, and they had a desperate quality. Because of the ongoing poverty, it focused their concerns more on social and economic issues rather than the more civil and political rights that are being discussed more in Kabul and also more in urban areas.
Is security a big issue for them?
Well, interestingly enough, the women I spoke to, it was not. I know that security is a big problem in Afghanistan, particularly for women. But the women, particularly in rural areas, explicitly stated that it was not a significant problem. However, security issues are quite sensitive, and if women were being attacked or targeted or sexually abused in any way, it isn't something that they would have discussed with me. But they did say that they were not concerned about security.
Well, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Karen Hanrahan just spent 8 months in Afghanistan as she was discussing her experiences speaking with Afghan women and girls for the United Nations Refugee Agency, now with Amnesty International here in Washington, and that's where we reached her today. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tonight in New York, four journalists will receive the 2003 International Press Freedom Awards from the Committee to Protect Journalists. One of the recipients joins us now on the line from New York. Sameh Hamed is an independent writer, publisher, political cartoonist, and a poet from Afghanistan. And welcome to Talk of the Nation, and congratulations.
Thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
When the Taliban came into power in Afghanistan, you had to go into exile in Denmark and spent some years there. How has your experience been since your return to the country?
Yeah, when I returned to the country, I started to publish three free publications. One in Mazar-e-Sharif by the name of Kalak Raskoy, another in Baghlan province by the name of Talaya, and the other one was also in Mazar-e-Sharif by the name of Osmana. We started the publication of these free publication.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the first free publication in Baghlan, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And also we had a lot of workshops on practical journalism and freedom of expression in different province of Afghanistan, because I think the idea of democracy is only just beginning to take shape in the capital, Kabul. Yeah, mm-hmm. We had capital democracy, and in other provinces there is no media, and there is little awareness of human rights, including free speech. Yeah.
In the places where you are allowed to publish, in Kabul and Mazar-e Sharif, is there censorship? Are you allowed to print what you want?
Yes. In Afghanistan, there are several kinds of censorship, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Because the situation for working journalists, especially free journalists, is confusing. All of those in power censor independent journalists. Just affiliated journalists are allowed to write. In the government, former supporters of the Taliban, for example, now call themselves democratic reformers, and also warlords have the key positions in the government. Therefore, there is a censorship against free journalists in Afghanistan. It is against free journalism, and we have a false freedom of expression in Kabul, because there is a triangle of power in Kabul. Karzai and his supporters, warlords, and the other one is the supporters of ex-king of Afghanistan. And they can criticize each other. They can write against each other. And when the international media comes for 2 or 3 days, they think that there is freedom of expression. But for free writers, for free journalists, there is no freedom of expression. Yeah.
Sameh Hamed, thank you very much for being with us. And again, congratulations.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Sameh Hamed, an independent writer from Afghanistan. He's going to be receiving the 2003 International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York later tonight, along with the 3 other journalists. And we also wanted to thank Kathy Gannon for her time very much. Kathy Gannon, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Is the AP Bureau Chief for Afghanistan and Pakistan. She's spending this year as the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Actually, I'm incorrect. Kathy Gannon is going to stay with us. Please excuse me. She's going to stay with us for a few more minutes, and we're going to wrap up this conversation after we come back from a break. Please excuse my confusion. I apologize for that. I'm Neil Conan. I guess I have to say my name now, and this is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And now we're wrapping up our discussion about Afghanistan. Kathy Gannon, the Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, is with us from our bureau in New York. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Peter, who's with us from Berkeley, California.
Yes, thank you. I speak Farsi, which is what they speak in Western Afghanistan. And I practiced in a clinic in Zaranj, a little town near the Iranian border, 100,000 people, for 7 months last year. Hmm. And so I have a feeling for the way things are away from Kabul. And Kabul is a long way away. I mean, you hardly get an echo of Kabul. Things are run by Mr. Karzai, who's, of course, a restaurant owner from this, picked by the Americans when Massoud got murdered. To run the country, but really we know very little of what goes on there. My own warlord, I'll call him Badawi, the head of Nimruz province, while I was there, the adjacent warlord from the east, from just east of there, tried to replace him and was driven off, and for a few days we had to flee across the border into Iran for safety. But the main point I wanted to make was to talk about women's rights in an area like this, it seems so unreal. The literacy rate among women is 1%, and among men is 5%. And I asked a couple of girls whether they'd like to learn to read and write, and this is while I was treating them. And they both kind of looked at me, what an amazing question. And then when I said, well, you know, if you did, you could do work like Masuma. We had a local girl who could read and write, who was helping us out, and they said, well, yeah, maybe. And then later, their fathers and everybody else around said, oh, if they tried to put a girls' school in here, we would fight. I mean, so the idea that we're going to get women's rights and democracy in our sense of it in a country like this anytime soon is pretty remote.
Kathy Gannon, is Kabul on another planet from many of the other parts of Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a real disconnect between any city and rural living. And it's true, Afghanistan is a deeply tribal, deeply conservative country. Before the Taliban, during the Taliban, after the Taliban, it is a deeply conservative country. That doesn't mean that people wouldn't educate the girls if you had a school right in their village, that people aren't interested in education. But certainly the gentleman is very correct in terms of a disconnect. But that's true between cities and rural areas, I think. And certainly, but I have to say that Hamid Karzai spent the entire time in Pakistan and Afghanistan, not in the United States running a restaurant. He actually was in Quetta. During the whole Taliban, he was the deputy defense minister during Massoud's first government between 1992 and 1996, the deputy foreign minister, rather. And he left because he was so outraged by the fighting between rival factions between 1992 and 1996 that led to the Taliban. So I just want to say that just to clear the record for President Karzai. His brother, for sure. But he has very consciously stayed in the region and has been a huge an active person with the tribes people in the region and trying to come up with alternatives to the Taliban, alternatives to the fighting between rival factions. So I think that's very important. But I guess I also want to say that it's a very critical juncture right now for Afghanistan, that what happens in different parts of the country, they really, it's very critical now in terms of trying to control these government ministers, cleaning up the government of these people who have kind of shown themselves to be more interested in their own money-making and driving the country really much more toward a lawlessness that brought the Taliban and the extremist element in the first place. And it's sort of slowly moving in that direction again. And that's something that has to really be tackled because these warlords, they are government people. They are government ministers. They are governors in the provinces. They are commanders and corps commanders. They are not acting outside. They are acting outside of the Hamid Karzai, but they are part of that administration. And so the people see them as part of the administration, and it just undermines the fact that they believe that Hamid Karzai, the president, has no authority because he's not taking the tough decisions to either get rid of them, replace them, clean up the cabinet.
Peter, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Kathy Gannon, at this time, I am going to say thank you again.
You're more than welcome.
And mean it, but we appreciate your time today.
You're more than welcome.
And again, Kathy Gannon is the Associated Press Bureau Chief in Kabul, and she's speaking with us from our bureau in New York.